Michael Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
Platypus, the extraordinary story of how a curious creature baffled the world by Anne Morrell. A very good thing. This is the fourth episode. We've done basically the British coming in and seeing what the platypus is, a bit more sophisticated French sort of large-scale view of the platypus, with sort of a curious ending of the French hiding their results and squirreling away marsupials into the royal menagerie, sort of still sort of being modern but not quite modern. And then we've seen the different Buffon and Leonis can't go head to head trying to work out what this animal is, and the chain of relationship between species is, in terms of the religious view, coming gradually unstuck in the third episode. This is the fourth chapter, and it starts with a beautiful quote. It's called The Wrangling Scientist, chapter 4, episode 4. And Harriet Vito, The Platypus and the Mermaid, her book. Even among naturalists, there was room not only for scholarly debate, but for deeply personal or eccentric alternative interpretations. Since his famous paper on the platypus anatomy, read to the Royal Society in 1802, Sir Everard Home was in the zoological ascendant, the leading British anatomist of his time. Yet, while the British interpretations of anatomy of the strange animal paused, France's leading experts were staking strong and divergent claims. Their influential Geoffroy Saint-Hilaire was the early protagonist of the debate. Geoffroy, who had added his given name to his surname in his youth, and is known thereafter by it alone. Oh, okay, it's Geoffroy. So he's added Geoffroy to his, so it's like Peter Hill, and then Peter. A dashingly brilliant figure in French biological science. He was a polymath and a romantic. At 15, he would become a canon in the church with prospect to a religious career, but the outbreak of the revolution, he turned his law, then medicine, and embraced the revolutionary ideas. At the beginning of the terror, he was responsible for the release of Abbé Hoey, one of the great founders of crystallography, in prison because he was a priest. And in recognition of his efforts, Geoffroy was appointed professor of quadrupeds, birds, at the Paris Museum of Natural History, age 21. Now, isn't that incredible? So the Natural History Museum was just thrust forward in the absolute caving in of the royal ascent scientific community. Lamarck got this idea for this thing, and Geoffroy is one of these people who get propelled at the terror. Isn't it amazing? When Napoleon organized his famous seduction campaign, Geoffroy enthusiastically joined, and from 1798 to 1801, his scientific inquiries in Egypt were filled with adventures and danger. He successfully rescued the important natural history collections he'd made while travelling up the Nile to the Aswan, and on his return to the museum in Paris, devoted himself to descriptive zoology and classification, resuming the research on marsupials that he had earlier begun. The platypus and the echidna quickly claimed Geoffroy's attention. Working at Holmes in descriptions in a paper in 1803, he grouped the two of the new taxon, in which he named Monotrema, describing it characteristic of animals, digits, claws, having no true teeth, a common cochlear opening, an exterior of a single orifice, and the absence of mammae, which is breasts. This is interesting. Oh, I find it interesting. But Geoffroy did not indicate precisely where the new order should be placed in the classicology system. The male specimens of the platypus brought back to the Museum of Natural History of Valparaiso a year later. The first specimen was a paradoxical animal to reach the French, the first specimen of the paradoxical animal to reach the French researcher. Evidently did not, because of its gender, add anything to the, to lure him further into print. During 1809, some 6 years after Geoffroy, Jean-Baptiste Lamarck, so he's the older person, entered the fray. Destined to become, so he's the founder of the French Museum. He was, I think, off to snails and worms. He got, they got different parts. It was interesting how the different sections, you got devoted to different sections, which were either glamorous or non-glamorous. Controversial figure in the evolutionary debate, Lamarck had early spread his interest over the botany and zoology under the powerful patronage of Buffon. Entered the Jardin du Roi in Paris. Okay, so the King's Garden was a menagerie to start off with. 5 years later, when the institution reformed to become the Museum of Natural History, which is Lamarck's doing, according to what I've read, he was appointed in charge of the Division of Invertebrates, where he was became known as Professor of Insects and Worms. There you go, I'm not so stupid afterwards. His famous philosophy of zoology, he created a new and different class for the platypus and echidna. In his opinion, the two animals are not mammals, since there's no evidence available of any mammary glands. Neither were they reptiles, since they possessed the mammalian characteristics of a four-chambered heart. Nor were they birds, as their lungs differed from those of the avian spirits, and they had no wings. Lark named this new class Protoheria, a name which remains in existence today. Well, isn't that incredible? Now, the one of the things I want to do, which I really didn't pick up, that both the platypus has the bill and the echidna has a little beak, a little pokey beak. It's something you don't see. You see, but you don't see until you've actually really thought about it. And seeing the, what's that, the local zoo, Symbio Zoo, this is my memory going back. And seeing the, albino echidna, just was so great because you can't really see anything when they're all black. Of course, they're well camouflaged. A young French doctoral student, Henri-Marie Ductre de Blainville, Bougainville is the name I was trying to remember before, went so far as to devote his doctoral thesis to the place on the Ornithorhinus, I'm going to have to learn to pronounce that, and the echidna should occupy the natural system. Fresh and inhibited by old ideas, as good as students are, Blainville contended in 1812 that, quote, too much had been written on too little direct observation on the subject of these ambiguous animals. Not only were few specimens from which to draw conclusions, and these seldom well preserved, but, as he remarked, quote, zoologists are after another misdirected by badly interpreted words, have finally come to the point of forming distinct and separate class, which they assume to be intermediary between mammals, birds, and reptiles. Blainville, who was destined to rise high as a comparative anatomist and independent thinker, saw mammals as descending with increasing complexity of structure and organization from the primates down through the marsupials to the monotremes. Okay. The primates. He divined many resemblances between the platypus, echidna, and marsupials to the point that he was first to make. He judged that while there was an apparent absence of mammary glands, the monotremes belonged regardless of the class of milk-giving animals. He assigned them the separate order Ornithorhinus, whatever it is. So it's the Protoheria, and this is Ornithorhinus. No one held the more illustrious position French biological sciences than Jules Cuvier. Now, Cuvier and Lamarck fought, I don't understand what about. From the last decade of the 18th century, he had swept like a meteor across the zoological sky. Isn't that beautifully written? Initially a candidate of the church, for the church, the young Cuvier had become entranced by natural history during his 6-year residence on the Normandy coast until he was brought through Geoffrey's influence to the post of assistant professor in comparative anatomy in the Natural Museum of Natural History in Paris. So what a turmoil in that natural history. And it's a fantastic museum. I want to, if I ever go back to Paris, I'd like to visit it. 3 years, Geoffrey Sr., Cuvier did not join Napoleon's Egyptian Court of Savants, remaining instead in Paris. He worked on the museum's invaluable specimens of mammals and birds. Indefatigable and committed to comparative anatomy based on organic structures and their relationships from one taxon to another, he published. And this is really interesting because these people are doing early science, and early science doesn't have commercial view. It's only recently now that we expect every scientist to have a commercial input. And this is not the way that science grew up. He published his Tableau Elementary de la Histoire Naturelle des Animaux in 1797, classified the entire collection to the museum in 1804, and turning to his famous paleontological reconstruction of fossils and bones in the Paris Basin, extended his interpretations to extinctions, to extinct forms. This is it's how do they become extinct? Were they evolving or extinct? Cuvier was an example of the dictum from the Gospel according to Matthew. To him that hath shall be given. I don't quite understand what that means. Beginning his career humbly in Normandy as a very thin, poor young man, marking excellent drawings of dissected invertebrate and fish, he rose swiftly, reaping praise and honours and great wealth. And he became a very fat, splendidly robed, famous man, rejoicing in the nickname Mammoth. His mature work, L'Origine des Animaux, The Reign of Animals, published in 1817, Cuvier placed the platypus and echidna in a third genus in the order of toothless Inundata, anteaters and sloths. He pressed the point that since travellers believe that these animals lay eggs, it is desirable that trained anatomists describe exactly these eggs, their origins within the body, and their development after being deposited outside the body. It was surely an examination, this preeminent figure in the world zoology sector, that could be made by many medical men who visited Port Jackson. The French researchers, true to Gallic fashion, differed animally on animals' taxonomic position and mode by which they produce the young. Geoffrey and Lamarck believed they laid eggs and were oviparous since, in both their views, the animals were not mammals. Blainville assumed the vaporous birth of live young. Cuvier, while consigning the monotremes with the amphibians, which at the time did not constitute the class in themselves, in the order of endantids, anteaters, recognized the peculiarity of their generative structure, with further evidence as to their viparous, life young, or oviparous birth, egg birth. The matter stood until the early 1820s, as the second-hand reports of the egg-laying platypus trickled in for the distant New South Wales. In the year 1824 would mark the crucial turning point. In that year, the German comparative anatomist Johann Meckel, whose watchful interest in platypus and the echidna dated back some 15 years, published a paper in Leipzig announcing that he had found mammary glands in the platypus. True, the glands appeared primitive, they opened directly onto the skin, and there was no sign of nipples, but the mammals were, he declared, the offspring might well be born alive. Although Meckel advanced the important and then revolutionary view that lactation did not necessarily require live birth. Marsupials, for example, brought their live young into a very embryonic forms. Monotremes, he suggests, might be egg-laying mammals, as they are. as such they would undoubtedly resent a transitional form. Personal interpretation of Meckel's discovery now sprouted like a mushroom in the freshening field. Blanfield eagerly accepted the German anatomist's announcement, since his position encompassed Blanfield's own chosen outcome that these mammals might produce live young. The great Geoffroy, however, offered a hot rebuttal. Since he had believed the overplay of platypus for some 25 years, Geoffroy rejected Meckel's discovery on the mammal's glands. They could not be mammary glands, his paper in 1826 asserted, because in that case, the platypus and a very absence of nipples would make feeding especially difficult for animals whose beak was so ill-suited for suckling. Mm-hmm. And the so-called glands were much more likely to be structures resembling lubricating glands of a salamander. Now, I remember they did a lot of work on salamanders. I can't work out what it was back then. There was a big Lamat. Okay. Satisfied with his own interpretation, Geoffroy claimed that the animal's anomalous organic structures meant that they were platypuses, that the platypus was a mammal in effect, but without true mammalian characters. It was this, he claimed, that justified the original creation of Monotrema as a special taxonomic order. Meckel fought back, cheered that the formidable Geoffroy had at least confirmed the existence of the disputed glands, even while declining to recognize them as mammal. Meckel was confident of his own discovery. In his more detailed and finely illustrated publication on the Ornithorhynchus, I'll have to learn to pronounce that, in 1826, he declared that while the platypus' mammary glands clearly differed structurally from those of other animals, their function was similar. From the specimens at his disposal, he had determined that the glands were quite large in older females and almost completely lacking in younger ones. The authoritative Cuvier, re-temporizing wisely, writing his overview on the progress of the natural sciences in 1827, again stressed that this was a distinction that could be hardly settled by, except by those who observe the living animal. The German anatomist Karl von Baer lent his support. Eager to assist his colleague and examine his dissections, Baer testified that Meckel's discoveries were indeed mammary glands. Moreover, the question of generation, there was merit, he thought, in Cuvier's P. The question of viviparity or oviparity, this live or egg, could not be solved unless the animal was seen to emerge from an egg. Geoffroy, having since had the opportunity of dissecting a female platypus, again fiercely rebutted Meckel. His view turned on the point that the connexious mammary gland possessed none of the characteristics of a true mammary gland, and there was no trace of nipples. He hence decided that the platypus glands were similar to the glands for secreting lubricating liquid disposed from the flanks of fishes and aquatic reptiles. And I love this QED. I love this so rarely. Quod erat demonstrandum. That's the end of the argument. The academic papers of the protagonists each published their own language in their respective national scientific journals, proclaimed the international character of the span of science. Naturalists communicated across linguistic national boundaries, but each, even while limited by the lack of access to well-preserved specimens and animals in dispute, fought tenaciously for his own scientific truth. In England, Sir Edward Howe, for the long arch authority of platypus's anatomy, was particularly threatened by these events. Meckel's detailed examination and papers challenged his reputation as the leading comparative anatomist, and the position he had staked out for his own dissections that the platypus produced the young oviparously from eggs that hatched within inside the body's mother. The body of the mother. No animal, as the president of the Royal Society of London reflected in something of an understatement in this annual address to that prestigious gathering in 1831, quote, has ever excited the curiosity of naturalists more than the platypus. A restatement of Britain's position in this rising conflict was now urgently required. In 1826, Richard Owen, of the Owen-Dixon line, I suppose. Is it Owen-Dixon line? Oh, I can't remember what it is. A recent appointee of the Royal College of Surgeons, assisting in the cataloguing and collection of the Hunterian Museum, which is from the Hunter gave the museum, entered the debate. With youth, pluck and driving ambition on his side, Owen prepared to defend Holmes' legendary status of the British supremacy in the zoological affair, which I think is wrong. I can't remember what his debate. Owen had clearly placed himself on a swiftly moving escalator to preeminent career. Losing his father at the age of five, this is interesting, he quickly entered the man's world, acquired a strong scientific learning at school, and joined the medical school of Edinburgh University, later St. Bartholomew's Hospital in London. Here, in brisk stages, he picked up considerable knowledge of comparative knowledge, anatomy and dissection, and while privately practicing medicine, and was appointed to the Hunterian Museum as assistant conservator in 1828, at the age of 24. Challenged, he rustled up an old female platypus specimen from the museum's collection and took the first step in a field of conflict in which he would play a commanding role. I love that. Play a commanding role. Conflict. So this person's brilliant. Right, look, conflict commanding, that's just searching a word, a groups of words which say so much or give such a spin to them. Its initial sally was not assisted by the state of the elegant specimen, and its dissections have not survived. But Owen's enterprise led to appeals being sent soon after to private secretary of the Governor of New South Wales to procure specimens of impregnated females of the for Sir Edward Home. So it's not for him, he's saying for his boss. Home himself, his reputation endangered, was soon back at the dissecting table, although the inquiries made of the Governor's assiduous secretary failed to wrinkle out much in the way of materials. Quote, the female, when it is in pregnant state, one correspondent replied to the secretary overture, is very shy and more difficult to procure than ever. But another settler, Thomas Bushby, caught three female platypuses, which he preserved in spirits, and in 1831 consigned them to England. The problem of efficient faunal collections was substantial. Specimens in prime conditions called for careful techniques. Preservation by bottling and placing in kegs required one deep immersion of the specimen spirits and a subsequent re-immersion with fresh spirits to achieve satisfactory results. However, the five specimens newly acquired from the colonies before him, Home brought in his home one-time assistant, Francis Boyer, brother of the illustrious investigator artist. Oh, wow. Ferdinand Boyer, and now botanist at Kew, working on three acceptable preserved animals, Boyer, after almost minutely examining the specimen, assured Holmes triumphantly that it could not find the slightest trace of anything like a mammary gland, quote, and found everything precisely as you have given it a long time ago. Make your genius. I finally endorsed Holmes' own dissection of one of the specimens in the distinguished nervous, assured the Royal Society that the animal did not possess the slightest appearance of mammary glands. Meckel had erred, either said home, because the parts of his specimens had been kept too long in spirits, or the shaft went home because the German scientists finally were magnified by the imagination of a mind proposed by the existence of mammalia. However, 30 years after his pioneering work on the subject, Holmes signaled a major change of mind, abandoning the oviviparity laying egg inside you. The illustrious old anatomist declared that the generative process of the platypus was probably, like non-lactating egg-laying reptiles, oviparous. Into this hotbed of controversy and theoretical speculations came a letter from the New South Wales. A reputable reporter, the Honourable Lieutenant Lauderdale Mall of the 39th Regiment, stationed in the colony, imparted the information to the Zoological Society of London, which conveyed tantalising reference to suckling platypuses and platypus eggs. During the spring of 1831, wrote Maud, being detached in the interior of New South Wales, I was at some pains to discover the truth. Truth of the generally accepted brief, namely that the female platypus lays eggs and suckles its young. Several of their nests, he recorded, were discovered with considerable labour and difficulty. No eggs were found in perfect state, but pieces of substance resembling ichor were picked out of the debris of the nest. In one nest, the male found a female and two young. She kept the female alive for 2 weeks by feeding her worms, and when she died, on skinnier while she was yet warm, he noted, he observed that milk oozed from the fur of her stomach, although there was no teeth visible. But on proceeding, two teats or canals were discovered, both contained milk. The body was a female and forwarded to Richard Owen. Bloody hell, poor platypus. To this information, the immortal Geoffroy countered with a lively French pragmatism. If first glance produced milk, let me see the butter. Oh, God. Geoffroy, he's French. Oh, platypus butter. As the papers of the contending European scientists ricocheted from the national journals, Owen was drawn directly into controversy. Moving mobile person, trying to support one person than the other. It's just typical bloody system crawlers, you know, so, I did the research, yeah, it's confirmed what's necessary for me to be promoted. I was drawn, in June 1832, he launched a major paper, quote, on the mammary glands of the ornithorhinochus paradoxus. Now, I think it's Loth's paradoxus. It was Duck, which reads, according to custom by their colleagues and fellows before the Royal Society in London. With characteristic clarity, Owen set down the puzzling problem of the Australian monotremes. The extraordinary nature of the monotreme quadrupeds of Australia cannot be illustrated more forcibly than observing that it is still doubtful what class of animal they properly belong. In the confines of the animal kingdom, it is less surprising that the species should occasionally be discovered, either so devoid of external character or of a form so strange as to occasion a difficulty in ascertaining its class. But the difficulty occurring with respect to a hairy quadruped affords one of the most unexpected as well as the interesting problems in natural history, and renders acceptable the smallest addition to a series of facts already ascertained respecting to the noblest creature. That's just wank, sorry. Carefully examining 5 fully grown female platypuses, including the one set by Moore, he noted the gland's appropriate positions in the abdomen of females and the absence of males. This and gave unequivocal confirmation to the existence of a mammogram, which marked, with marked sophistication, he compared the size of the ovaries with the lactating parts and found that the glands enlarging in different female specimens as the ovaries appeared to have recently executed their function. A young man rising, Owen's paper contradicted both the Great British Home and the formal Geoffroy on the anatomic grounds. In the following year, in the paper called Echidna Hystris, Owen was able to demonstrate that the echidna, the only other monotreme, possessed the same mammary apparatus as the platypus. Carrying Meckel's conclusion further, Owen firmly demonstrated that the monotremes should be classed with a milk-nourishing mammalia. This did not require a separate order, but he allowed this proof did not resolve the question of their reproductive process. The discovery, indeed, he wrote, quote, leaves us as much in the dark as we were before respecting the platypus's mode of generation and equally dependent on excretions of those naturalists who may have had the good God. Fortunate of observing facts in the living animals respecting the most interesting and important subject. The critical answer to the monotreme lay hidden in the Australian bush. Thus ends chapter 4. And we'll get on to chapter 5 soon. Thanks a lot for listening. Very interesting. I don't know what quiz questions I'll write about this one. But obviously about mammary giants. Thanks a lot for listening. Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. How you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.